Welcome to the Tetracast, episode 402, being recorded on July 5th, 2025. I am your substitute host, Josh Torres. Our usual host, Brian Vitale, is out taking a personal vacation at visiting a fan expo of some sort. I forgot what it's called.
He's at a Denver Fan Expo.
Denver Fan Expo, yes. James is out as well. He's at Anime Expo right now. The Boulders are happening this weekend, as you just heard. Joining me for this podcast is Adam Vitale.
Hello.
Mikhail Madnani.
Hello.
And Chow Min Wu.
How's it going?
So we have a bit of several weeks ago, me, Adam, and James went to SGF, and then James was out again on assignment for Anime Expo and hanging out there. Brian taking some taking some time off, and we're here at sort of a long weekend here in the U.S. the day after 4th of July, so everyone's most people are enjoying a long weekend. On that note, it has been kind of a weird week. A lot of it, obviously not so great that we're going to get into, especially at Microsoft. We're going to be talking about that. But in terms of new releases, not so much on the RPG end as for new releases, but that does allow us to revisit some of the RPG DLCs and title updates that we haven't spoken about here yet. Adam, you found some time to play that new free DLC for Sea of Stars, and they were marketing this as, like, it's not only a free DLC, but it is a good chunk of hours, at least over 10 hours. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so I recently finished up, like, System Shock 2 remake or remaster, and I wrote about that. Basically what I said on the podcast either last week or the week before. And we're in a kind of a lull of new RPG releases. I'm not really into the gacha stuff, so I see a lot of the memes about Persona 5 or the Phantom X, and you talked about it last week, but I'm not really into that. So I've been finding time to kind of, like you said, go back to some of the updates and DLCs that I've released recently. I don't think I talked about it on the podcast, but I actually recently went through the Aiden Chronicles DLC. This is a bit ago, but there was three of them, right? There was, like, Chapter of Marissa, Chapter of Sane, and Chapter of Marcus. I don't think I talked about this on the podcast.
No,
anyways, it's about $24, I think, for all of them, because I think they're $8 each. And each one can be beaten in about 40 minutes. So that means you could complete all of them in about 2 hours for $24. And, like, it's really extraneous stuff. I'm not going to say there's nothing in there that's worthwhile at all, but it's just, like, not worth it. It was one of the worst DLCs that I've, like, it felt to me like they promised it in the Kickstarter. Like, it was a stretch goal. Like, hey, if you fund us so much money in crowdfunding, we're going to do extra chapters. And of course, people reached for those stretch goals and they got them, but now they have to deliver on them, and the follow through was limp. So I think I said this before, we talked about when these DLCs came out, like, I really hope, however they follow up this game, that they can avoid some of that Kickstarter baggage, that crowdfunding baggage. I think all of it in that game just dragged it down. So that's an example of some DLCs that I played that were honestly pretty awful. Just value. Yeah.
I think you and I don't think we mentioned here on the podcast, but, like, when they formally announced the follow up to AUDEN and we hear that it's crowdfunding, it's kind of raises a red flag for us in that regard. Mikhail, you wanted to say something?
So I didn't bring this up on the podcast because I haven't played much of it yet. But when I was talking to Adam last, when we were just casually talking about Aiden, I mentioned that whenever I buy games, I like having all the DLC together. So I'll probably waste money on, like, pointless pre-order bonus fluff like I did with Kingdom Come Deliverance 2. So with Aiden, I noticed that the season pass itself was almost the same price as the deluxe edition on discount. Because 505 Games just had these weird discounts for the DLC separately. And just thinking about that now, with knowing how short it is pretty crazy that I can't, like, if someone bought just the base game before and they spent whatever you need to for the season pass versus what I spent on the deluxe edition, and I already feel a bit ripped off knowing it's like, what, 2 hours long or something if I have to get through it all. So yeah, just like some of these stretch goals and Kickstarter things, just it reminds me of Bloodstained Ritual of the Night, where as much as I like that game, you can tell it keeps reminding you that, yes, this is a Kickstarter game. Here are these random portraits for like backers and stuff. So like you said, right, I hope whenever they do a sequel, I hope it's like its own thing and it doesn't feel like a Kickstarter project, bracket derogatory. So yeah.
I mean, kind of the same thing. The Bloodstained 2 or whatever that's called, they called that, is not a Kickstarter game, right? So the Scarlet Engagement.
Yeah.
So I kind of hope a similar thing happens where they can work on a follow-up without that. But anyways, so that was one of the DLCs I tackled and I didn't really care for it. I also did the Lies of P Overture DLC. It took me about like an hour because I played Lies of P when it released, you know, almost 2 years ago. And it took me a while to realize, like, oh yeah, how do I play this game again? Oh yeah, you have your main weapon, and then you have your little offhand, like, robot arm that does a thing. And like, oh yeah, you have these, your abilities that require these soul gauges or whatever. It took me a while to remember how to play. But after I kind of got over that, like, relearning, I enjoyed it a lot. And I know James talked about this on the podcast. But yeah, that's a really good DLC. Really cool. Some of the bosses, especially the final boss, I think are really, really neat. However, it took me a while to get to it. And I guess I played like a nerfed version of the final boss. I remember people talking about how hard it was.
You didn't beat it. It's over.
Yeah, I don't have the pre-nerfed version of the DLC downloaded. I beat the baby version. But anyways, yeah, that's a really enjoyable DLC. But then I still had more time to spare. Like, I'll try that Sea of Stars DLC, Throes of the Watchmaker. And that one is interesting because it's free. It's absolutely free. And that game also came out about 2 years ago. Actually, I think just right around the same time as Lies of P, honestly. So Sea of Stars, broadly, I liked kind of some of the styling of the game. I liked some of the combat system in terms of its like weakness system, in terms of its the different character abilities and having to hit different locks to lower damage and things like that. And I liked some of the timed hit components of it. I wasn't as big of a fan on any of the writing parts of the game, but going into Throes of the Watchmaker being an absolutely free DLC, I didn't really know what to expect. But I'm honestly pretty impressed by it. So basically, it's a post-game DLC. It's only available after you beat the game. And it's storyline, it's completely separate. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with the main story. It's just kind of a side thing. For this DLC, you're basically given three characters. You have Zale and Valer. And then you have a new third character, Artie, who is like a robot. And the thing is it changes up Vale and Zalair's abilities from the base game. So the whole theme of this DLC is like circus performers, right? Valer becomes basically a trapeze artist, and Zale becomes like a juggler. And so their abilities are brand new. So functionally speaking, you have three new characters, how they work in battle. And there's some cool, like, you know, it's kind of a cool tweak on things in terms of how you approach like the combat and different abilities that are available. And I've always appreciated that with DLCs, where it doesn't feel like just more of the same. It's actually kind of like, you know, it's obviously the same framework of the game, but it's like, we're going to make things just a little different here and like just rotate things a little bit, tweak it a little bit to, in terms of how it actually like plays. So it's kind of interesting to see some of those adjustments in the DLC. The DLC is about, I think, 6 to 8 hours long. I didn't really time myself playing it, but it's pretty substantial for what it is, especially compared to like Aiden Chronicles' $25 2-hour DLC. It was just solid. Like, it had a lot of dungeons. It had a lot of, like, the dungeons were kind of reminded me of Golden Sun. They're very puzzle focused. And I know some people really don't like puzzles in dungeons, but I kind of do personally. And figuring out, like, there's block pushing, there's switch turning, there's things where you're lining up different totems in a room to try to open up the way, things like that. Arguably, it might be too many puzzles, but it was just kind of dungeon design you don't see very often anymore in RPGs. It kind of felt nostalgic to me. And yeah, just kind of cool twist on the gameplay, cool twist in the battles. This game, I forgot how good it looks. Like, I really like the pixel style for it. So
they did an excellent job, just the general art direction for that game. It's very, very crisp pixel, and the pixel animation of it is all very intricate in the way that the characters especially animate in battle when they do their moves. I'm kind of interested, in terms of, like you mentioned, there's like new quote unquote classes for the two main characters, so they have new move sets in general. Does that really make a substantial impact on how you're approaching battles compared to the base game? Because I know the base game, one of the things that annoyed me about the base game is a lot of the moves had very there's long animations to them that you had to engage with every time you wanted to do burst damage, because a lot of it was maybe doing some of the ping pong things with the lunar projectiles and all that stuff, from what I remember. How does their new abilities and movesets stack up compared to the base game?
I mean, the moves are all brand new, and it does have that sort of Mario RPG type stylings where your basic attacks, if you press, the action button at the right time, it'll boost the attack, and you might do a second hit type of thing for the attack. But then, for example, Valère is a trapeze artist now, and one of her actually highest cost ability is a trapeze, one of those bars hanging from the circus top and that you kind of swing around, right? And so that attack does have a slightly extended animation because you're kind of swinging along that and you have to press, the action button whenever it hits the enemy. It never really bothered me that much, but it is more than just, press attack and the attack happens. You do have to it does have to line up and do the attack. And I know what you're referring to, because that sort of extended battle animation has bugged me in some in Mario and Luigi games, especially Dream Team. It's not as bad as Dream Team, that's for sure. But for example, in the main game, in the base game, Belair is moon element and Zale is sun element. And so when an enemy does an ability, they might be powering up an ability, and there will be these locks on the enemy icon basically saying you have to hit them with three sun element attacks to basically cancel out this ability that the enemy's going to do. So that's all, tweaked now, because now it's kind of silly. Valère does bonk damage as a trapeze artist. Okay. And Zale does fire damage. He's a fire breather type circus performer. So their elements have changed up because they're no longer sun and moon powered. I mean, the functionality is the same, but it's just their abilities are new. So you aren't doing the back and forth reflection of the moon thing. That was one of Valère's main abilities in the main game. You don't have that. There are one nice thing about this DLC is there are not only is it there are the DLC story dungeons that you're going through, but there are side objectives, and there's side objectives. One has to do with some battle arena. There's one that's a puzzle thing. There's one that has to do with the wheels mini game, if you remember that from the base game. It's where you have the different little icons on these little you play them in the bars in the game. That returns. The story itself is basically, if you remember the Watchmaker in the original game, they're just kind of an NPC that you encounter at one point that they just kind of move the story along during a minor section of the original game. And I'll be honest, I don't even exactly remember what they did precisely, but you basically go back to them and kind of learn a little bit of a backstory there. And you kind of enter this sort of fake watch world, which is a circus themed world. And there's basically an evil there that's kind of taking it over. Like I said, unrelated to the main story, I didn't really remember what happened in the main story of this game, besides the broad strokes, but you don't need to know it. It's kind of a separate thing. And narrative stuff, it's fine. I was just more appreciative of the fact that it's like, hey, kind of just taking the game as it was, brand new, you know, dungeons, brand new enemies. Your characters are basically acting completely differently in terms of how you play them. And a lot of content in terms of not only the puzzle dungeons, but side content, challenge stuff. It was just kind of like, and this is all free? That's nice.
Yeah, it's really nice. You know, basically a big thank you to the players, you know, because that their sales are like way higher than they expected of the base game. And just like, hey, thank you so much for supporting us. Here you go. Just high quality, free post-game DLC if you want to play more. You know, that's really cool of them.
Yeah, and it is fairly challenging. It even actually gives you a warning when you start the DLC. It actually says, like, hey, this is a post-game DLC. Enemies are, like, there's literally a pop-up that says, like, this is a post-game DLC. Enemies are going to be more challenging than they are in the main Sea of Stars games. Be ready, kind of thing. It's kind of fun in that regard, too. Just, you know, that friction and that challenge to get through it. And, of course, like with Liza P, had to remember, like, how do you play this game again? It's a turn-based RPG, so it's not that complex, but yeah, I enjoyed it. Now, if I were to, like how much would it be worth had it not been free? I don't know, but it's free, and you don't see that very often. I think I can think of a few games that do, like, free updates, like, obviously, like, there's Monster Hunter, I think of, like, No Man's Sky and things like that, but you don't really see that too often, especially in, like, pure RPGs where you get, like, a free update that's more than just, you know, like a small bonus or something. It's actually like new, like a brand new chunk of content, like stories, dungeons, and battles that are completely standalone. Like, yeah, I appreciate it. I do.
That's and you know, Sea of Stars, it's pretty much available on like all modern platforms, I think.
Yeah. I don't know if it was on like Game Pass, and is it still on Game Pass, or I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that either. Yeah.
There is one last thing. If you do, so one of the things that you can collect in this DLC, there's a big clock in the game. And you collect all like the numbers. So there's basically 1, 2, 3, all 12 numbers that you collect. And I think these are all optional things that you can find throughout the DLC. And if you collect them all, you do get like a bonus epilogue scene. And I'll be honest, I couldn't really make heads or tails of it. And like, is this a tease for the next thing from Sabotage Studio? Because, you know, they made The Messenger. Then they made this, which is sort of related to The Messenger, but tangentially. So I wonder if this tease is sort of like a tease of Sabotage Studio's next project that might be, once again, tangentially related. I don't know. But there is a tease in there for people who might be curious about the Sabotage Studio cinematic universe. I don't know, but it's there. It's cool. It's just kind of a cool like optional thing that you can unlock if you get it.
Yeah, I wonder if they're going to announce their new project, because it's been some years, you know, from Sea of Stars. Obviously, they released this DLC for free, but I have to imagine their headways into whatever they're doing next. It'll be interesting to hear back and see what they have up their sleeve now. You know, very talented studio. Cool. Thank you for checking out the Sea of Stars DLC that released, you know, several months ago. Mikhail, we have a new title update for Monster Hunter Wilds. Capcom continues to support that game. They had a recent Capcom showcase that formally introduced it and revealed it. You know, obviously they teased the return of Lagaiacris, one of the, you know, more infamous monsters, let's say, in the Monster Hunter series for a lot of veterans. And they also newly announced that Seragios is coming to Monster Hunter Wilds, and they released that title update. You've been messing around with it. Tell us about your experience with title update 2 for Monster Hunter Wilds.
Yeah, so it was an interesting timing for the release, because like what happened last week on the podcast is I had to leave early because I was really unwell, and I honestly shouldn't have been on the podcast for like the last half an hour, because I was like, I don't know what happened, but I was unwell for a few days, and I was hoping I'd be fine for the title update, and thankfully I was. So there were three things I wanted to check in the title update. The first is obviously the new monsters. Second is the quality of life stuff which they promised. But before both of those, I was hoping they'd do something to the PC version, because while I don't play Monster Hunter Wilds on PC anymore, I just like did it for testing on Steam Deck and ROG Ally. It was unplayable on both of those, so I just like deleted it. But I have a lot of friends who played it there, like who played there, you play it there, James plays it there, or at least y'all, and you think Brian also played it there. And all of y'all were hoping for performance improvements and just general improvements to the game with stability. Now, I brought this up an episode or two ago, because what happened with the Street Fighter collaboration update is the stability was just completely gone on PC, where people weren't sure if their save was going to load. Performance was getting worse, so it was just like a complete shit show on PC for a while, and then the Steam ratings, the Steam reviews for it dropped to like mostly negative. And despite some like articles from some places which tried to imply that it's because of the content or whatever, 99% of the reviews that I saw, like everything which I was scrolling through, everyone was just saying that fix your game, I can't get into my save, it runs worse than it did at launch and stuff like that. Now what they've done is, it seems they've improved performance a bit based on like a few friends I've spoken to and looking at some of the reviews, but I don't think it's enough on that front, and stability seems to be improved a little. But again, like this should be like an alarm signal for them that you drop everything and you fix your PC version, because it's like a huge part of your player base for the whole franchise now. And this is not like a want to treat that audience. Like, you know, I joke about how Elden Ring is pretty shit on PC as a port, but like, I think Elden Ring is way better than the current state of Monster Hunter Wild. So Lagiacris and Seregios are the highlights, but then there's also another quest which is called Fashion Hunter, which I found really nice, because first, Fashion Hunter is now canon in Monster Hunter, which I don't think it was before. It was just like a fan coin term. So what you have to do in this is, when you start the game, when you load into your save, you have to talk to an NPC, start a quest. You go and take on Lagiacris, then you do Seregios. But the Fashion Hunter thing is with Gemma, she tells you she wants you to dress up a specific way. So you have to equip different layered armor for your head, for your chest and everything. You get rewarded with Gemma's chest layered armor, which you can use on the male and female hunter body types. This is a pretty funny quest with like interesting cutscenes, and I hope they do more of these, because it was like a very pleasant surprise to see this. So I hope everyone who is still playing Monster Hunter definitely does this, because not only does it introduce you to like the layered armor system if you've not bothered with it before, but they definitely put a lot of effort into this. Now, the other thing is Lagiacris. I've fought Lagiacris in Monster Hunter Generations Ultimate and in Stories. I never played Monster Hunter Tri because I never owned a Wii U. And I don't know if it was in Monster Hunter 3 Ultimate, because I barely played that on 3DS. I'd say like maybe 30, 40 hours, but I don't remember much of it. So in Wilds, Lagiacris is very interesting, because they take you underwater for some fighting, but this is not like a full underwater experience. You have to use your slinger, get slinger ammo, and then start. It's kind of like one of those, I'd say it feels like a cross between an underwater arena and a siege Monster Hunter fight. So it's interesting, but it's not something I'd want to do when I'm farming Lagiacris. So the first two times it was fun, but after that I hope there's a way to like do the quest without the underwater section in the future.
Kind of detail how they implemented the underwater portions of the fight. Hold on.
Yeah,
because like when they introduced it, we got a little bit of the, you know, just a brief clips of the footage of like sometimes during the fight, the guy Chris will go underwater. You have to chase after it. It doesn't seem like to be a full on, you know, underwater combat like in the entry that it was introduced in. It seems to be like a more gimmick focused. Kind of tee us up, explain what it used to be before, like why it became infamous in the community, and how did they try to, you know, implement it into the Wilds without the underwater combat portion of it.
Okay, so I can't comment on how it was in Tri or 3 Ultimate, if it was even in there. But what happens in this is, when you're fighting Lagiacris normally, there'll be a thing where it just jumps into the water and it's like preparing a powerful attack. Now, all the hunters will like get a prompt to jump into the water by pressing like circle or the right face button. And then over here, it's just moving underwater. It's shooting its lightning at you. You can dodge like while you have swimming. So you have like some swimming controls which you can like swim towards it or swim, like, dodge against the lightning. And what happens is, you know, like how when you're fighting some monsters in the ice arena, you can use your slinger and get those pillars of ice to fall on the monsters and do damage. So they've brought some of those things into the underwater part. So if Lagiacris goes near some of these like stalactites type pokey things, I don't know what you call them underwater, you can press like your slinger and you can get it damaged over there. And your aim while it's underwater is to stop it from doing its, like, preparing its big attack. So you keep doing DPS to it. I don't know if it's a DPS check or not, because what I was doing specifically is you get slinger ammo and you keep firing at it and you can attack it, and you can, it's sort of like, you can even mount it in a way, like, you know how when you mount a monster, they've added that mechanic as well to some degree underwater. So it feels like Capcom's brought in a few different systems to try and make the underwater portion more than a gimmick, because it definitely did feel like a gimmick initially, but they do have you doing stuff. So it's not like you can just ignore this, and it's not like a fluff thing. They have added it. It is a big part of the fight when it goes underwater. You cannot ignore it. And, it's not tacked on. So I'd say, as someone who hasn't experienced the true Lagiacris in Monster Hunter try, I think this was a good tease of it, but I would like to see, if they do an arch-tempered version of this, I would like to see them build on the underwater section more for... it could be like one of those, you know, like how you have a final boss fight where you don't do it too often, you do it for the spectacle one. So I would like to see them build on it for that. But right now, it's the main normal fight is a little... It's kind of like, okay, the tempered Lagiacris is the real fun. And I say the same for Seregios, but before I get to Seregios, tempered Lagiacris is like an actual menace in a way because of where it moves. And I think a lot of the players who have been, like, I've just joined randoms and I get with them and I've been playing with a few people in some servers, I think people really underestimate the tempered version of these monsters, because everyone does the normal monster and they just like, okay, I can just use my same gear, and then we do the tempered version and like three people cart in one go. So Lagiacris just hits harder. I think some of the moves have been tweaked a bit, but it's just more aggressive in general. So I think what they've done with this title update is the normal monsters are just like, let's introduce them to new players. And then the tempered monster is what Monster Hunter players want to do. So I'd say with Lagiacris, they did a very good job with the tempered version. But I would like to see them build on the underwater for the arch-tempered version, but not too much in a way, because I don't want to keep doing the underwater section if I'm farming it, if that makes sense. Because arch-tempered you usually do for like the gamma armor and get better layered armor. So, oh yeah, one more thing I want to comment on is Lagiacris's theme is really good in Monster Hunter Wilds. The start is a bit weird in a way where I thought they were keeping it a bit subtle, but it goes really high in the middle, and I think they did a fantastic job with it, because I listen to a lot of Monster Hunter music for games I haven't played, and I think they've nailed the theme, the arrangement in Monster Hunter Wilds. Now for Seregios, everyone who played Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate will know Seregios. Seregios was also in Sunbreak, one of my favorite monsters over there. I think one nice change they've made over here is the bleed mechanic, which Seregios' main thing is bleed. Like, it shoots its scales at you and you start bleeding, and if you start moving, you take more damage and tick damage and stuff like that. So you have to heal. What happens in Wilds is you can't do what you do in Sunbreak, where you just, like, you know, Seregios over there, you just, like, bend down for a bit and you just instantly heal from bleed in a few seconds. That doesn't work over here. Seregios is much more aggressive over here. And I don't know if you did a lot of the... Did you fight Gormagala in Wilds? Like the late game one? So do you remember how annoying it was to fight Gormagala in those closed corridor passages?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So Seregios gets into some of those places and it's a lot worse because it's so aggressive and it keeps moving so fast that people just... They can't deal with the lead and they just get carted in the tempered Seregios. So the one thing I've not done yet is I've not actually crafted their armor yet. I've just fought them like 11 times each or something, the tempered and the normal one. I haven't actually forged any of the armor because I was unwell for like a few days. I've just been catching up with pending work after that. So I will get to I'll get to crafting the armor for both of them and seeing how things go. But there is one last thing I want to talk about with the title update is the quality of life stuff. Do you remember how annoying it was every time you wanted to restock or change anything? You had to go back into your camp and like wait 2 seconds for the cutscene. Capcom listened to us and they added an item box outside the camp. Praise the Lord.
Oh, that's good. Can you just access it at any time out of there?
Yes, you can just access your item box. You can do whatever you want out of there. You can't... I don't think all the functions are available, or they've made it so that your item box, just like how it is in the older games, is now available outside the tent, thankfully. So there's less time wastage happening.
Okay, so you can just place that item box outside the tent. It's not something you can just like pop open the menu for. It's still a physical...
It's still the item box, but you don't have to go into tent every time. Uh-huh. You can just get it outside it. So it's like one step less. So that's a nice thing. They've added a lot more quality of life stuff with like unequipping all decorations together instead of manually doing it and stuff like that. But as soon as I finished farming them and like doing whatever I needed to update my guides, I just closed Monster Hunter and went back to Yakuza 0, which I'll talk about at some point. But yeah, that's... I'd say that Title Update 2 is better than Title Update 1 with all the fixes they've done and with the content they've done from my point of view, but it's hard to praise them given the state of the PC version right now, even though it doesn't affect me directly.
I think it's one of those things that's like they still have a lot of work to rectify whatever the fuck they did to the PC release. It's still overwhelmingly negative on Steam. People are... And that's been going on for many weeks now. It's just people are not happy with what they've done to that version. This has been an ongoing thing since release too, where it's like, you know, people weren't thrilled with this performance at release. And it just got worse over time, which really sucks. But it's also like the cadence in which they're releasing these title updates, I think for a lot of people, it just feels like it's like, too little and a little bit too late. Like, it's like I feel like that wave has already passed, and it's in terms of like, you know, that's totally fine, like, you know, people kind of moved on to other games and stuff, but it just feels like compared to past releases, it just feels like the cadence that they're releasing these title updates for, it might be, I don't know, maybe too slow for a lot of people. Just like they kind of, at least from my perspective, I kind of wish they just released a more complete game, because the game that we got at launch felt incomplete, and then a lot of this stuff is like, you know, kind of too little in my, like, I'm just waiting for, I guess, the major expansion to it at this point. But that's the big caveat of like, hopefully they fixed everything like on the technical side of things. Because right now, I just don't care to engage with a game that will barely function at this point.
I definitely see that, because I was looking at the... I was looking at the cadence of updates which they've been doing for the past games, because I didn't play Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate and Generations and 4 Ultimate. I didn't play them pre-release because like I wasn't reviewing this stuff back then, and I think Nintendo was handling these releases or whatever. So for those, I've been playing them from day one, and those were like, at least Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate was like a fully patched, like with the G version and everything.
Yeah.
But I was there with World, I was there with Rise, I was there with, like, I've been there for everything since then, pre-release and post-launch. I think there's one thing, looking back at everything and looking back at the cadence of updates, Monster Hunter World definitely spoiled us with just the sheer amount of updates they were doing and the collabs and stuff. I've been talking about Monster Hunter Rise multiple times, even with, like, I played it with James pre-release, and like, it was like, I'm not even gonna mince words, it was frankly dog shit what they released day one, and they fixed it 2 months later, and then we got nothing till Sunbreak. That's how they handled Rise. Sunbreak was like fantastic and stuff. I think with Wilds, what's happened is, yeah, they definitely, like, you know, the gathering of not being there was like, I thought it was a design decision. So I thought, okay, you know, like, maybe they don't want to do that for this game. It's fine. But it definitely feels like they held that back, or it wasn't ready in time. Even if Title Update 3 and 4 come out sooner, like, how is that going to help people who aren't sure if their save file is even going to load? So that should be, like, Capcom needs to put more resources into this, because they need to either get external help, or they need to just get more people fixing the PC version. Because if you have a game which is overwhelmingly negative on Steam, good luck selling a $50 expansion to them.
Yeah, you know, I it's just, it's a huge bummer. And what you're saying is right. Just ultimately, they need to figure out something for this. I didn't, like, it's really tough because like it feels like they're not even conveying that like there is some like things in the patches that say, hey, we're looking into the Steam version, but it just feels like they're not really earnest in their message to like really look into this and fix it. Like they haven't really
I agree with that for sure, because this is like, if it was just mixed or something, you can just be like, oh, it's just people, whatever, like, you know, it's not running well because they're on low end rigs or people aren't happy with something, it's fine. But overwhelming negative is you need to like do something drastic to get this back, otherwise you're not going to be able to sell DLC, you're not going to be able to sell a standalone, you're not going to be able to sell a massive expansion, and you're just going to drop players, because the other option which players have is you discount Monster Hunter World to like $5 or $10 with the expansion multiple times. That's a game which runs like perfectly even on Steam Deck. It's a game which has like years of updates and it's completely perfectly fine to play now. So even if someone has played like Monster Hunter World and they want to play the new one, they can just go back to Iceborne instead, because they don't need to worry about their save not loading anymore. That's the reality for Capcom, and I'm frankly a bit worried. Like, it's not something in our scope specifically, but I'm frankly worried about what they're going to do with Resident Evil 9 on PC, because for Capcom's PS5 generation only games, it's not been looking good on the PC side or the console side. Although at least with Monster Hunter Wilds, they put effort into the PS5 version and the Xbox Series X version. I'm a bit worried about Resident Evil 9.
I have to imagine it's going to be okay because we know the RE engine is like, it works on like smaller scope, more enclosed environments. It is not built for these big open world zone games like Dragon's Dogma 2 and Monster Hunter Wilds. Like that's demonstrably, hey, this engine is at where they are at this point in time in terms of it's developing it and developing that technology. Clearly, they still haven't like, you know, figured out how to make it play nice in those that design framework of an open world scope, big open world, you know, zone. Like right now, it's just like it's a shit show on that front. But in terms of like smaller scope, hey, like how Resident Evil Requiem is looking to be a more enclosed environment, I'm more optimistic on that end that it'll play more nicely. But if they announce something like more like another big open world thing and like it's gonna be on RE engine, it's like, well, fuck, you know.
Yeah, I think some of the trailer footage looked a bit more open, so I was a bit worried. But yeah, like, I think Resident Evil is definitely not going to be as open as Dragon's Dogma and Monster Hunter, so yeah, should be fine. But I don't know, I'm just like, you remember what they did with the Resident Evil 2 and 3 when they added the ray tracing update to PC, which was the PlayStation 5 and Series X features and visuals? It was so bad that they had to add a beta branch so people could access the old version. So that's kind of why I'm a bit worried. I forgot about that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I forgot they had the kerfuffle handle that happened. Yeah.
So it's a bit iffy with how they handle that. But like, I said, again, this stuff doesn't affect me directly because like I can play on PS5, but you cannot ignore Steam for these games. You can like, if you know, like how people joke about how like Wild Hearts looks like shit on Series S and stuff, and Street Fighter 6 also does not look good on Series S. Like, it's kind of bugged and they haven't fixed it. It's kind of embarrassing for Capcom that it's been bugged for over a year and they haven't fixed that. But then, you know, like, the player base is probably just not there, but you can't afford to do this for your number one or number two player base. Like, Capcom needs to figure this stuff out.
Definitely. You know, honestly, I'm at the point where I just kind of wish they just like re-release Generations Ultimate on Steam and then with network play and just leave it at that, and then everyone's happy.
It would, even like I said that in that Monster Hunter backward compatible article also, like, Generations Ultimate deserves better than being capped at 30 FPS and 1080p with that blurry UI on Switch.
Yeah, like, obviously we know, we were aware of the fixes that you can put on emulators, like the Ryuge and X branch and everything. Like, we know that there are,
it's not people... even that, even a friend of mine overclocked his Switch 1 and was able to get it to like 60 FPS on that, so the 30 FPS was just like a design thing. I believe in Japan you can, there's crossplay with the 3DS version or something like that. I think that's why they had to keep it at 30 is what I read, which is like, okay, but that doesn't affect everyone outside Japan who'd never had EU, so it's just one of those things, like,
they're caught between a rock and a hard place in terms of this.
Capcom has done so many, like, Mega Man, they've done Resident Evil games on GOG and stuff. Like, we need some classic Monster Hunter games on modern platforms.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Well, thank you for checking in on title update too. That they'll still have like I think at least one more title update coming this year.
Oh, they have two more. They have two more. Yeah. They said.
Okay, so for this year, cool. Okay.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens with those whenever they're ready to share more details about them.
I was going to ask: is the Onimusha still using the Resident Evil engine?
That's still RE engine for sure. Yeah.
Mm.
So.
But yeah, I'm not too worried about Resident Evil 9. I don't think the scope would be that big. Like, you know, you'd be just in small hallways most of the game, probably, right?
We'll see because they said like, you know, like we're gonna be busy a post-apocalyptic Raccoon City. Like what was it, like 30 years after the nuke happened to it? So I think there will be at least a little bit more open locations, but I don't think it's gonna be a full open world. But we'll see when they're ready to show more of that game. But they did kind of tease that it'll be maybe a little bit, there'll be more open spaces in that regard because they want to revisit Raccoon City in that title. Now, what they've shown so far, pretty isolated, closed environment. But I think, you know, I feel like the optimization on it should be ideally better than what it was in Dragon's Dogma 2 and Monster Hunter Wilds. One would think, but who knows? And then I think Pragmata is in a similar boat. I don't think that's an open world thing. That's seems to be closed environments based on what we played at SGF. It seems to be a more smaller scope thing in that regard, which would benefit it. Onimusha, same deal. Probably going to be linear environments, linear stages. I can't imagine it's a more open world thing in that regard too. So those titles should fare on paper better.
But I also have a question for you. If you go to those gaming events, like, do they play like on a state of the art kind of machines? Like, it's like, oh yeah, here's a game, but it's actually running on a 5090 or something like that.
No. It depends on it's a case by case. It's never one size fits all. Some people showcase their stuff on PS5, some on Xbox Series X. Most people do like obviously a pretty high end PC, but not all.
Like, for example, our Digimon demo was on a PS5, but Digimon should run well on anything, you'd think.
I think our Pragmata was on PS5, or was it just a PS5 controller to a PC? I couldn't tell. I think it was a PS5. They hardly ever show things running on a lower spec PC on those events. They obviously want to showcase it running at its highest settings and running perfect, ideally, if it's not like too early in development.
Well, that kind of reminds me, like, there was an Assassin's Creed update recently for Shadows that was basically for like ultra low specs, and I feel like, you know, a lot of, you know, enthusiast gamer types may not care about that because there are a lot of people, us included, are rocking at least pretty good, if not excellent, builds. But when you're trying to hit like a wide player base, having those updates for like ultra low specs or, you know, modest spec PCs, that it takes effort to do that. Like Ubisoft did that with Assassin's Creed. I haven't followed up on it, but I know they had that update recently, and that's cool, I think.
Yeah, and like we're definitely not majority here. Like whenever Steam releases like the results of their hardware surveys, you know, most people who are playing games on Steam are not even on like quote unquote modern good, like, you know, GPUs. They're usually like, I forgot the most recent one was it like 2070 or 2080 as the most popular now or something prevalent on Steam. So it's definitely, you know, when you're thinking about like the chunk of players, the majority of players who are engaging with games on Steam, you know, they're not like running high-end rigs to play the latest like high-end games. You know, you see like people who are still playing a lot of Counter-Strike, for example. You don't need a crazy rig for that. Or Balatro, you know, you don't need a crazy rig for that. So it's definitely what is the quote unquote the biggest game in terms of like what people are pushing on you on, like, what's the graphically, what's the highest, like, you know, what looks great, is not necessarily always getting, like, the most players, you know, in that regard. So, things to consider. All right. Thank you, Adam, for sharing your time with the Sea of Stars DLC, and Mikhail for your experience with the title update 2 at Monster Hunter Wilds. For me, I haven't really been playing anything too major that's within our scope. Mecha Break, the competitive, you know, PvP multiplayer mecha game, finally came out, like, full release, not in beta form, on Xbox and PC. So I've been playing that with some friends. That's been a lot of fun. I it's one of those things that, like, I enjoy the gameplay, but the monetization in it is kind of not sitting well with people. The devs themselves have done a lot to improve what they had in terms of, like, the latest playtest, because people had a miserable time with, like, the latest beta before its full release, where if you wanted to play more of the mechs, you had to play, like, a bunch of games and do well in them to earn enough in-game currency to gradually unlock them, and that felt really miserable, because for some mechs, it took way more currency than others. For example, it was just, like, a very grindy, tedious process. Now at the full release, they give you full access. You can unlock at, like, 12 mechs at the start. There's, like, 3 unlockable ones. One is, like, through the battle pass. And then there's, like, 2 that you can get with, like, the in-game currency in it. And they're, like, the newest mechs that they haven't shown off before. So they found, like, a decent middle ground on that end, where, like, when you boot up the game for free, you have a bunch of options from the get-go. You don't have to, like, grind necessarily for, like, to unlock the majority of the roster to play them. But, like, in, like, customization options and a lot of, like, the, you know, people like to play dress up with their pilots and then obviously the mechs here. A lot of that stuff feels prohibitively priced, I guess, in the way that they're handling that sort of stuff. For me, I'm here for the gameplay. I like the gameplay, so I don't know what's considered the perfect middle ground on that end, because I booted up, I play for free. Maybe I'll put some money to the battle pass just to show, like, hey, show some support, because, you know, I like the game already in that regard. But in terms of, like, playing dress up, it doesn't really bother me, so maybe that's why a lot of the monetization, probably valid complaints, you know, just I don't really feel it as much, because I don't really fired that game up to play dress up with my mechs and my pilot at this point in time. Like, I'll put a color paint over it and or stick with the default colors and be done with it, but I'm here for, like, hey, I really enjoy the game for, like, the gameplay. So but I can see, like, you know, a lot of people have concerns in that regard, and we'll see what they say to that.
This doesn't really matter, but one of the former marketing managers at Square Enix now works at Amazing CSUN Games.
Oh,
and
interesting.
They were actually like, oh, so what can we do to get you to cover Mecha Break? And I was like, I don't know. It's not really what we do, but
yeah,
this is it. You talking about it right now. This is our coverage of Mecha Break. So
I mean, I played it, I enjoy it with friends, you know, it's cool.
Like, so there you go, Jay, former Square Enix, now at Amazing CSUN Games. This is our coverage. This is what we can swing.
You know, for me, I enjoy a lot of the mechs in this game, the way they play. And you can tell the people who made this game, like, have a really deep love of the mecha genre, even down to, like, how one of my friends described it is, like, when you're deploying into battle, you're, like, at that loading bay when you're about to, like, launch, very emblematic of the mecha genre, of, like, when, like, you know, the Gundams launch from, like, their base, you know, it's a big moment in that series. And this one, when you're launching the battle, you're, like, at this hangar, and all the... You'll know that the people of this the people making this game have a love of their mecha genre, because all the different animations for the thrusters of each of the mech are all unique. Like, the way that they are presented and the way that they animate and move, they're all distinctly different from one another, which is, like, you know, for any lesser developers who don't really care about the mecha genre, like, will kind of have a default maybe A or B, like, thruster animation, because maybe it's not where the flashiest thing is for a mecha. But for here, it's like it's all different in the way that they move and animate. It shows. That's fucking awesome. But just very, very small details in that regard. So it's great. Like, you know, I can't wait to play more and see how the game evolves. I hope it does well. But obviously, you know, it's not the greatest in terms of, like, its monetization balance for a lot of people. I've also been continuing to play Persona 5 The Phantom X. I have about like 42 hours in that game now. I enjoy like a lot about it. Obviously, I won't praise, you know, the way that the monetization of it works. You know, there's a lot of like those annoying pop-up ads like, hey, when you pull a 5-star standard banner character, it'll have a pop-up that says, hey, you can get a dupe of it and like some extra like, you know, gacha currency for like $16. Do you want it? It'll just only last 3 days. I hate that. If you're talking about the value of it, like sure, like it's like, you know, you could probably make the argue the case like, yeah, doing $16 for a dupe of like a 5-star is like great, but like having that be FOMO and pushing it up against you sucks. Like that's awful monetization. Like why even make it FOMO? Just why not just give that person, you know, the option like permanently until they feel like it and don't like push it on their face. You know,
that's it's scummy, but you know, I know. Yeah. But it's just like coming from other gacha games where they're not so generous, it's like, yeah, that $16 is a bargain to me, but
and that's one of those things that like, I think that's a new feature for global in Japan. Like I don't think the Chinese server also had that either. So like it's like, ugh, you know. But as you were talking about earlier, Adam, in terms of like exploration, especially the palaces in this game, like the palaces are ridiculously big. Like I'm at the second palace now and I'm like, I'm working to 100% it. I'm at the cap where like you can finish exploring the second palace, but you can't do its final boss yet until the next, you know, story update in that game, which is, I believe, is coming next week, because, you know, it's a live service game, has these updates. But it is nice that like, hey, when you go through that palace the first time and it's introducing mechanics to you, in that regard, you maybe explore maybe a grand total of 20% of that palace just from progressing the story alone. And there's a lot of like other side paths that you can backtrack, because like you usually need like additional like dungeon mechanics to open up, like say like key cards, or in the second palace's case, you have like different colored talismans that you acquire as you're pushing through the story of that. And once you're done with that like story, and you have like all the like, you know, the key cards or the talismans that you need to access all the places in the palace, you can go and backtrack like a good chunk of that palace. And like a lot of that palace is progressing, you progress through it not through like, you know, very basic linear room to room, just kind of empty places. Like there's a lot of puzzles as you're progressing through the palaces. Like in the second palace alone, you have mechanics like different cameras where you have to put different types of film on them. And that film, when you go view things through the camera, they can manipulate like, you know, the sizes of like wooden boxes, for example. Like some wooden boxes might be in your way and you need to like shrink them. And then there'll be other wooden boxes that are like smaller size that you have to put them on a big panel, and you have to find the camera to go enlarge them so they push down on that button. And then there's like another camera type where you can like put this sort of like chroma film on it, so you can engage with these like blue holographic doors of either phasing that door out so you can progress through it, or you need to phase that door in to engage with another mechanic in that puzzle. There's like platforms with water that have whole mechanics there where you have to flush out the water and then get stuff at the bottom of it. And then that might be like getting film and then putting it on a camera. So you've got to use that camera to enlarge the platforms on that. So when you raise the sea water level, you can traverse through them. There's like a whole like minecart aspect to some of the cameras, and like fixing the tracks so they can go travel along those minecart sections, so you can engage with another thing to put down like spikes and obstacles in the way. Like it's filled to the brim with like just puzzles, and like when you're exploring and trying to fully explore a dungeon. And that's just like the second palace alone, and there's like all those mechanics. The first palace has like really cool puzzles where there's like there'll be like a map on the wall with all these symbols, and you have to use the mind's eye mechanic from like Persona 5, where like it shows you like the interactables. In Persona 5, in this one, you'll want to use the mind's eye mechanic for some objects where they'll like highlight something on you, and then though you'll see, like, in the first dungeon, the tablet that you're highlighting shows a path. So when you go into that room and you see, like, a similar, like, panel thing, you have to reference that map that you mind's eye on to know, like, the exact, like, correct path to, like, get to solve the puzzle in that. And that's kind of, like, one of my favorite aspects about it is they really did not skip on, like, the palace dungeon exploration. Like, I'm a big fan of, like, kind of elaborate dungeons that have puzzles that you need to engage with.
Yeah, I was just talking about puzzle design in dungeons and Sea of Stars, and I feel like Persona 5 had them, of course, but you don't see puzzles all too often anymore in RPGs, because a lot of games are like now open zone or like dungeons are more like battle corridors where you just try to get from like one end to the other, and a lot of the design it goes into like combat encounters, like encounter design and battle design, and less so on that out of battle stuff. So I always kind of appreciate it when you see those sorts of like exploration elements, making it so you have to solve, it doesn't have to be like, you know, super intricate, but some sort of out of battle, you know, problem solving to figure out something. And I always find this kind of an interesting discussion topic, because there is a contingent of RPG players who will argue that like puzzle dungeons are like an outmoded design that don't have a place anymore in the genre. And I disagree. I like them. It can't go overwrought, but I always like a little bit of, you know, give me something to do outside of battle that's not just finding my way to the next battle.
Same here, especially because for me, that's what connects me to the environment. Like that's what makes me care about the environment that I'm exploring, is like, hey, have something for me to do in that environment to make it memorable, you know? Because now these dungeon mechanics in Persona 5 The Phantom X, like, I'll remember them because, like, oh, they had those, like, interesting puzzles that I did in them. That Mikhail, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, what Adam was saying just reminded me of that Shin Megami Tensei 5, that fan platforming puzzle, which was basically the only puzzle that game had. And that game, that puzzle had like such a reaction that they had to nerf it a few patches later.
I like that puzzle. And I remember. I liked it.
Yeah, I mean, I went through hell trying to get that done like pre-release, because for some reason I missed one of the platforms for whatever reason. And I think it's because I was either playing handheld and I couldn't see it or something. But I remember that, like, I'll never forget that moment pre-release doing that. And then this is like one of those things, I beat it before they made it easy. Like, I did the real experience. So it just reminded me how SMT5 just had that one puzzle platforming thing and people just could not deal with it. So they had to like nerf it. So that was just funny.
Good luck with those people if they ever play Nocturne. They're not that fairy
or Strange Journey, you know.
Or Digital Devil Saga. What are they going to do when that comes out? Or if they ever re-release that.
Hopefully soon. And also just another thing that I've really, I kind of dabbled in it like last week, but they kind of, I've seen more of it this week in terms of like puzzle boss fights as well, where like, you know, and most Persona, especially in modern Persona games, like the fights in them are pretty straightforward for the most part in terms of like, hey, find out the enemy's weakness, try to knock them all down to do your all-out attack. And that's your general, objective in fights. While in Phantom X, it has like a lot of like elite enemies that have challenge fights to them. So now I'm getting to stuff like in the second palace in terms of like their puzzle design, where there'll be an enemy that has like a counter timer to it, where like, hey, there'll be adds that spawns with it, and some of those adds have utility functions, where one add might give it HP restoration each round, one add will sap like 15 SP from your party every round, and then there's like these two adds that just by being there add on to its like progress meter, and when it reaches like a certain like number in this progress meter, it either inflicts like an ailment on you that is really, really bad and makes the whole fight tougher, or transforms into a new demon altogether that has like super increased buff stats that it's gonna be really challenging to survive against it. So it's almost like a rage timer for these adds. So you have to, and all of these adds and that boss has like different weaknesses to them, and they all have down points, meaning the where if they take a weakness damage, that won't automatically knock them down immediately. You have to shred the down points first in order for them to be knocked down. So you have to kind of start balancing different things and start prioritizing, like, hey, which ad should I deal with first while I'm trying to still maintain damage and do sustain throughout this fight, especially because some of these ads will drain my resources and restore its health along the way. So what do I value, like, in the first two turns of the fight, and what's my mid fight strategy, and how do I like clean up this fight while trying to avoid that rage that rage timer on this mechanic of the fight, you know? And for me, like, I really like challenge puzzle boss fights like that, because like you have to really think about like your team party composition, what are the strengths and weaknesses of your party members and their kits, and what do you need in terms of synergy and also sustain throughout that fight to kind of make steady progress to get through it.
And speaking of puzzle boss fights, CSR's DLC had some, and nice. I didn't talk about it before, but I'll just bring one up right now. So one of the bosses that you fight is like a narcissist, and when you fight him in the battle, there's like five different mirrors. I won't go into all the details, but there's like five different mirrors that can show up on the battlefield. And basically, when a spotlight hits the mirror, the narcissist likes that because he likes looking at himself in the mirror, right? Very cartoony. But like, you basically, what you have to do in the battle is you have to hit the spotlight so that it's not hitting the mirror. And so, you know, a lot of bosses in RPGs, we're all veterans of the genre here, you know, you buff up, you heal, you do damage when you can, heal up when you need to, but it's cool when you have those like optional things that you have to take care of. Like in this particular case, it's you have to manage like where the spotlight is and where the mirrors are, because you don't want the spotlight on the mirror in this case, because if it charges up, he does like a super attack that does a lot of damage, so you want to avoid that. So it's just kind of this little extra element to the fight, where not only you have to care about, you know, doing your strongest attacks or making sure your buffs and debuffs are in place, but also like you got to make sure you always keep an eye out on where the spotlight is. So those types of things are cool.
Yeah, it makes me wonder like if they ever re-release Digital Devil Saga, both of those games, what modern discussion will look like for the super bosses of those games, especially when they're like kind of involves a calculator.
Yeah, Digital Devil Saga 1 super boss, you can brute force. Digital Devil Saga 2, you pretty much need to just read the pattern and just follow it.
Read the pattern and keep a note on like how much damage you're doing to it.
Yes.
That's a fun super boss. Very memorable. But yeah. So that's what I've been up to. I've been enjoying both still, but you know, not a lot of like big new RPG releases throughout this month. You, speaking of that, though, you updated your RPG release list as you do at the beginning of each month, Adam. Any sort of like releases that people should look out for in July for RPGs?
Yeah, so every month I post the release dates. Every month I update it more than once a month, but once a month I post it. And it feels like for a while there's always been like at least one interesting game, like really high profile, high, you know, anticipated game. But this month, not so much. There's a few games coming out that look like they could be interesting, like Wu Chang Fallen Feathers. But yeah, when I posted this month's RPG list, a lot of the replies I got were things like literally like crickets. Like everyone, like some people just like there's nothing here. Because I think the first RPG that comes out this month that I had listed was like Eden Zero, which, you know, that's an anime from the Fairy Tail guy. And if you don't care about that anime, then you don't really care about this game, right? And then Wu Chang looks cool, but it's from a new developer with not a whole lot of a pedigree. So it's kind of a who knows. And then I don't even remember what else comes out this month.
Yeah, you had Wild Hearts S as well.
Oh, yeah, Wild Hearts, yeah.
Switch 2. And that it's one of those games that's already like pretty well known. I think the only thing that's like kind of interesting is like they upped the player cap on multiplayer from 3 to 4, which is not something you see often, but obviously that means that you can't play with any other players from previous platforms on it. So I don't know if that'll get, you know, a second wind and on that front, being a Switch 2 exclusive and being isolated on that platform. Obviously, it's going to be interesting for people who want to test out, like, the technical performance of it, of, like, how Switch 2 handles that. And like, the neat thing about it is like, hey, it's being published directly by Koei Tecmo, not EA anymore as well. And you also had listed here Mado Monogatari, the Western release of the newest Mado Monogatari game that released in Japan. I forget if it was last year or several months ago, but
it was like last year, November-ish, I think?
Yeah, maybe it was late last year.
According to RPGsite.net, it was November 28th.
There you go. So, yeah. So, but until then...
I'm interested in checking it out, but it's like, I don't think I'll be like fully committed to it. I played the old ones on like the PC Engine with like the Ariel and like, it's like the Puyo Puyo cast, right? They're like the official games, and then Puyo Puyo is like the parody, but the parody became more popular because of the puzzle games, right?
So. Yeah.
And Neverwinter Nights is also getting a re-release the remaster this month from Aspyr. Neverwinter Nights has always been one of those games I've been interested in, and like, I like Obsidian, and they did the second game. I don't know if I kind of want to play Neverwinter Nights 2, but I have never played the first one, and I know they're kind of standalone, but even so, I still want to play the first one, and I just never have. But that's coming out this month, and that'll be interesting to keep an eye on.
So yeah, I think for anyone who's like looking forward to like brand new RPGs, I think people are very, very curious about how Wu Chang is gonna shake out that. So maybe we'll have to say if we get something about it, we'll report back on it. You know. let's see what else. I think that's it in terms of like just
pretty dead month for RPGs.
Yeah, Mikael, did you want to say anything about like releases this month, especially like for Game Pass RPGs? Anything up on that front?
Not anything on Game Pass yet because they haven't announced those. But I think Wu Chang is in Game Pass, right?
I think so.
I feel like it is.
Okay.
Yeah, and Neverwinter isn't. And then there's like not an RPG specifically, but it is something which we are covering, which is going to be the new AI, the Somnium No Sleep for Kaname Date.
Oh yeah, is that so? That obviously forgot.
Yeah, that is. It's in. I think it's in less than 2 weeks now, if I'm remembering correctly. So that is there, but then that's like it's a spin-off game, and it's like we'll see how that goes. But yeah, like the one I am anticipating the most is definitely Wild Hearts S, because I enjoyed that game a lot despite its tech issues. So I want to see if they balance the weapons differently, because like you have four hunters now.
Yeah.
So how are they going to deal with that? And also how the online works and stuff, because like, frankly, that game is unplayable on PC handhelds completely. Like you just cannot get that thing to run on Steam Deck, whatever you do. Even if you try running it at like 400p, if that's possible, it just is not playable. So like, that's one of those things I want to see if they've like, it'll need bespoke stuff to get it working over here. So we'll see how that goes when it shows up. But it's just mainly that. And I probably want to play Neverwinter Nights 2 because like I like Obsidian a lot. And I've not played this. I don't own the previous version which they released. So I want to give this a go. And we'll see how the rest goes. But I was thinking this month might be the time I finish 100 Line. But who knows?
I need to get back to that game too. I don't know about finishing it, but I definitely need to make forward progress on it. I've been slacking. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's going to be a chill month, all things considered. We're going to move on to the news. And, you know, as I kind of teed up earlier, the big story of this week is, you know, it's a downer, that's for sure. All the news that I'm going to be mentioning here is from Video Game Chronicle, and they also sourced the Seattle Times as the first, like, you know, report of it. So this is about, I think, around Wednesday, we got word that Microsoft laid off as much as 4% of their entire workforce, and that's roughly over 9,000 total employees across many, many, many departments, all departments, including the Xbox gaming division. And, you know, that's, and then we got, you know, word throughout the day that, you know, several projects that people were looking forward to have been canceled. One of those projects was Rare's Everwild. That was announced many years ago now at this point, like maybe 2019, I believe. But it's been in development for way beyond that. We also got word that Perfect Dark is being canceled as well, along with the newest MMO from ZeniMax Studios, who is currently, you know, running Elder Scrolls Online. As a follow-up to that, Rare, the layoffs at Rare, longtime employee Greg Males, who was the Seas of Thieves director, leaves Rare after 35 years following the cancellation of Everwild. Obviously, other employees at Rare were affected as well and got laid off.
And also, I think John Romero's game was also canceled.
Yes.
That game was never announced, but according to LinkedIn posts, that game and that whole studio just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. So yeah, the Romero games. They lost funding in the wake of the Microsoft cuts. It fucking sucks, man.
And according to the Seattle Times, which Seattle Times, of course, Microsoft is based there. Yes. So they have insight. A lot of the reporting I know is sourced from the Seattle Times. A lot of this has to do with Microsoft's push into AI. They're planning on spending billions, like $80 billion, I think is a number that a lot of people are throwing around, into AI. And the way that the Seattle Times puts it is, it doesn't mean that the company is replacing workers with AI. Rather, right now, the cost of building the AI infrastructure has Microsoft looking to trim costs where it can. So, quite literally, like, cutting salaries of people that it thinks are not necessary in the gaming division and elsewhere so that they can build their AI infrastructure. They're shifting their priority in that direction, which sucks. So,
yeah. There was also, I didn't see it on VGC, but I do recall that there was also Turn 10 was also affected very heavily.
Oh, yeah.
Losing us up to like 50% of their workforce, which is insane as well, because Turn 10 feels like one of their staples and one of the most consistently performing developers on their end. It's it's a heartbreaker, man. Like, this is, I don't know where. I mean, obviously, you know, Microsoft as the company as a whole will endure, but their Xbox gaming division, I feel like they're lost. You know, I don't know where they go from here. You keep on bleeding them dry, like year after year. This is what, like the fourth or fifth round of layoffs.
Yeah, so this is the number here is 9,000, but May 2025, which last time I checked was not that long ago, had like 6,000 layoffs.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, what were you thinking, Mikhail?
The Turn 10 thing is, like, I don't know what to say about that, because when you think of Xbox, there was this, you know, everyone brings up Gears, Forza, Halo. Halo is in pretty much a mess right now with Halo Infinite, but like, thankfully, I mean, they did gut the studio. I think 343 had some stuff going on, which I don't remember if it was layoffs recently or it happened before, but I feel like Turn 10 felt like this untouchable part, because they had a rough, like Forza Motorsport, the new one, which doesn't have a number, was, it's pretty much like, I consider it my worst purchase on Xbox, but I bought it because I trust them. So I still think that doing this is, and doing it to Romero is just like baffling to me beyond anything else. Like, do they not see what they're doing and the optics it brings, regardless of everything already which is being damaged internally and externally for them? Like, I just feel like surely someone sees, you know, like what's going to happen if we fire people from our premier studios and like completely kill the franchise. How is that decision even being made? And like, how are the people who are making those decisions at Xbox still there? It's just like, the Romero thing is like, I've not stopped thinking about it since it happened. So I just don't know what to say about that. Like, how are these people still there?
And also, one thing that I'm kind of concerned about is, I remember years ago when Xbox acquired Obsidian and In Exile, like, I had my caution, but I was trying to be optimistic. Like, this could be a good thing, because In Exile, a studio that I like Bard's Tale, I liked Wasteland, they have pretty much had to crowdfund their last several games. They had to crowdfund Wasteland 2, they had to crowdfund Bard's Tale, they had to crowdfund Wasteland 3, and like, hey, this is like publisher backing. What can the studio do when they don't have to do the crowdfund dance, right? And they're working on Clockwork Revolution, right? And then Obsidian, basically for their entire history, years upon decades, they've been kind of tossed around unceremoniously from publisher to publisher, from Sega to Square Enix to Paradox and so on. And like, now that they were under Xbox, I was like, maybe they can have some stability there. But I'm just sort of, I'm worried that like, once Outer Worlds ships and once Clockwork Revolution ships, like, I would be scared if I was in those development studios. Like, once you release those games, they're like, well, we don't need the whole studio here anymore, we're gonna start cutting, right? And some Absolutely. People like from Avowed have already left, like mm-hmm. like Carrie Patel, who was the director of Avowed, she's not at Obsidian anymore, she's at Netflix I think now, and I kind of don't blame her for jumping ship. Obviously it might just be personal like opportunities and whatnot, but we've seen before where once a game ships and, you know, is out on the market and the dev team can kind of like scale down, like it doesn't necessarily, I don't know, it's an awkward situation to be in, especially with everything else that's going on. So
yeah, especially because like we know, like, you know, from the some accounts in terms of like how Microsoft's angle on laying off people, some form of it, especially the gaming division, is if your game isn't in, like, at a certain threshold of development, or you don't have like a solid pipeline already in place for it, then you're probably not gonna see that project out the door.
I mean, we saw that with the Hi-Fi Rush team, right?
Yes,
Tango. Yeah. Like, as soon as they pushed out the game that Xbox leadership praised, the argument was that because their next project was too far away from launch,
yeah,
they got cut.
It's just, so like, ridiculous. So yeah, it's what can you even say at this point? And there's already, you know, some offhand accounts and murmurs from like an ex Microsoft executive saying that, you know, that Microsoft doesn't have like any aspirations like continuing like the hardware division. Obviously, that's not confirmed in any way, shape, or form. Just like, you know, that's the talk behind the scenes of like, is will Microsoft even have like new like a new Xbox Series whatever?
Well, the thing is they actually kind of like teased one already. They started teasing new hardware. Yeah, it's just like, yeah. I don't
it's
know.
It's not from those leaks, right?
No, they actually literally, no, it wasn't just a leak. They actually like posted on their social media accounts basically saying we're working on new hardware, like an official announcement. And it's just like, okay,
so they cut everything.
It feels like they're aimless and nothing is hitting, and it's just like, and it's like, and for what purpose? Like, you know, like investing in AI, you know, it's just like, oh man, it was. I still think like one of the most recent, most damaging things they did recently is that whole Activision Blizzard cost, like acquiring them, because that took so much money to do. That now the Xbox gaming division has like a giant red target on their back of like recouping those costs from in the eyes of the parent Microsoft company. It's like, now you have to really do your part to justify your existence after this big expenditure on acquiring these massive studios, you know, which is a little bit of the blowback from that, you know, on some level we're experiencing that. This is kind of the consequence of it, because, you know, the acquiring those studios that didn't have people flock to the Xbox ecosystem, probably in what they projected it would do. It sucks. It sucks.
Yeah, like I liked Obsidian for a long time, but I definitely, do I want to buy The Outer Worlds 2? Like, I thought The Outer Worlds 1 was okay, and this really isn't even a game quality thing. It's just like, I want to support Obsidian, but I don't want to support Microsoft. And so right. What do I do?
Exactly. You know. So yeah, I mean that's kind of the Microsoft stuff kind of all summarized there, but just like throughout the day on Wednesday, we were drip fed information over time through social media, like sources like Jason Schreier, and even for some employees there, they were getting that breaking news from Jason Schreier before the parent company told them about it. You know, which is ridiculous, because some people found out they're like being locked out of Slack and be like, okay, am I screwed? It's like, well, according to the department, Jason Schreier, and sure enough, yes. You know,
and this isn't even getting into the whole the fact that Microsoft is basically a key company on the BDS like boycott right. list.
Yes,
for the palace, for their basically for their involvement in the Palestinian genocide, like
yes, absolutely. But the parent Microsoft company does not care as long as the number goes up and people want to continue investing in AI because that will somehow pay off in the long run for sure. Who cares, right?
I was gonna say, I think one of the dumbest things I seen was like the producer Matt like Turbo told like all the workers that got fired, you know, it's like, hey, you should use AI to reduce your emotional and cognitive load when it comes to job losses. Like, do people have no empathy or something like that? He deleted that post.
Yeah, just to be clear, Matt Turnbull, whose position I don't remember, but he literally went on LinkedIn and was like, hey, for people who were laid off, try typing into AI what you should do for your job search and how you should cope with your job loss, basically.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. So
that's like, disgusting. That's vile. So yeah, that's kind of the big news story that's circulating this week, which is, you know, you never want to see it, but it's reported on. Anime Expo, as I mentioned earlier, is currently happening. One of the big announcements out of that, and you know, Mikhail is very happy to see this. They announced that Cyberpunk Edge Runners 2, the anime series, is, you know, that very, very, very popular anime, Edge Runners, that premiered several years ago. They had greenlighted a sequel and now being announced. Obviously, CD Projekt Red and Trigger are collaborating on developing it for Netflix. Mikhail, what have you learned about it?
So, I think when we spoke about it last time, I don't remember if it was on the podcast or off the podcast, Adam said they did hint at something happening with Cyberpunk and Netflix or something happening with Cyberpunk and anime. I thought, you know, they'll just do something else. I literally never expected more Edgerunners, not because it would make sense for them financially, but just it felt like something they would be just done with and maybe we'd see something with Cyberpunk 2. Now the timing might actually make sense. I think James posted about this on Blue Sky that he expects this, or he thinks it might be airing when Cyberpunk 2 is out, and that would be super smart on all ends, because Cyberpunk got so much interest back. Sorry, Edgerunners got so much interest back into Cyberpunk that I remember it was hitting new Steam CCUs around that time, and it got people to give the game a shot again. So I'm trying to figure out what they do over here, because they said it's a standalone thing, and if anyone's watched Edgerunners over here, I don't, like, they'll probably have some, maybe some characters appearing in some form, but you're pretty much going to have to do everything, like, just tell another story of Night City. Now, yeah, who they go with, and
yeah, Edgerunners, like, they approach this thing
with, it, you can't do much more with that, and regardless of, I think, they haven't, the other Edgerunners thing which was supposed to happen at Anime Expo was the Guilty Gear Strive thing, but not to go on a tangent, but I don't think they announced the date for that or anything, did they?
I don't know if there's a release date, but they have a collaboration of like Lucy from Edgerunners going into Guilty Gear Strive as a collaboration DLC character.
It's just a summer date or whatever. Okay, fine. Yeah. So yeah, back to Edgerunners. So the person who directed episode 6 for the original is handling the direction for the whole thing. It has the same screenwriter from what I can tell. One of my friends who's in Poland joked about how, when I posted it on Blue Sky, he joked about how I'm more interested in seeing what random Polish rap songs they included in this. And I was like, okay, send me a list of what they had in the original. And he said, there's just one, but it was super random to the point where I started laughing. I'll give that a listen later, because it has so much licensed music, which is perfectly implemented. So I am trying to remember where this was. But yeah, I'm very excited for this. The promo art they have looks fantastic. The logo itself looks good. Not having a date kind of tells me this is like 3 years at least away. What do you think?
Yeah, I when they first announced this, and obviously we had previous news that CD Projekt Red is currently putting the Cyberpunk 2, like the sequel to the game, in production. It really makes me wonder. It really made me wonder how far out this new Edgerunners season would be, and how close it would be, like in conjunction with that game sequel, because we know that game sequel is way further out. So I have to imagine Edgerunners 2 comes first. But I do wonder, like, what's the gap between them in that regard.
Speaking purely games, like, it's very obvious if you go by, like, CD Projekt's headcounts, and they actually publish, like, how many people are working on each project of theirs, that Witcher 4 is their next thing. And that's probably a few years away. So Cyberpunk 2 is going to be after that. And my guess is, if this anime airs 2 or 3 years from now, that might be Witcher 4 territory. But I have a feeling Cyberpunk 2 is probably more like 5 years from now. So, at least.
Yeah.
So yeah, my thought is, just with Mikhail, that this anime probably comes out before Cyberpunk 2. Now, I still think this anime is still 2 or 3 years out, probably, but I think just the game is probably even further out. It is sort of funny. So I know this isn't the only person, but I think this is like a perfect anecdote for like the type of audience they tried to get. I have a friend who is a huge like Gurren Lagann fan, Trigger fan. What was the studio that was before Trigger? I'm blinking.
Gainax.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he's like, he's a huge fan of this sort of stuff and not so much into like Western RPGs. Although he likes some Bethesda games, but like Edgerunners came out and he was disappointed at first. He's like, why is Ima Ishii working on a cyberpunk anime? Why can't he be doing anything else? And then he watched it and then he loved it. And then he played Cyberpunk and he loved that too. And this is well after the game released. And now he's like, hell yeah, they're making a new Cyberpunk game and a new Cyberpunk anime. Like, everything's coming up my way. So, like, the anime introduced him to this game that he likes now, or maybe more than likes. And, of course, he's excited for the second anime. So
it's interesting to see, like, how, like, you know, both the game and Edgerunners, like, got opposite sides of the spectrum of, like, people who don't really dabble in anime or people who don't really dabble, like, Western, like, action RPGs. You know, they were able to find a middle ground to convince people to give both of them a shot. And, you know, for a good chunk of them, she still, like, you know, fell in love with the other, where they were so convinced that they wouldn't. So it's like a perfect marriage of sorts. I think it's really interesting and pretty smart of them that to pass the torch over to Kai Ikarashi, who Mikhail mentioned was the episode 6 director of the first Edgerunners. And then Hiroyuki Imaishi won't be the primary director on this one, unlike the first Edgerunners. But I think it's really cool because the one is the directorial role for Ikarashi, and episode 6 was such a big like when you talk to people about like their favorite episodes in Edgerunners, a lot of them will say episode 6 because that was such a very unique sort of the way that the storyline and the way that it visualized the themes that I was going for in that story in episode 6 that had a profound effect on people. So giving Ikarashi that directorial role is very, very exciting. I'm always excited when newer people get their hands on a directorial role, because it lets their style permeate throughout the entire thing. It's not just a one episode thing. It's like you can feel their touch throughout the entire thing. So that's really cool to see. So I'm very curious. Edgerunners was awesome. I enjoyed it a lot. A lot of people enjoyed it. And hopefully, you know, Edgerunners 2 continues to... I, I, I don't want Edgerunners to be to exist in the shadow of Edgerunners 1. I want it to be its own thing and to kind of try out, you know, be its have its own identity. Don't live in the shadow of the first Edgerunner. That's what I hope for. So very exciting to see them formally announcing that at Anime Expo just recently, and then like as of recording right now, they're releasing like the teaser trailer on that and all that stuff. Great to see. Next up here we have Kladden X3. It's coming to the West digitally for PS5, PS4, Switch, and Steam later this year. There's a pixel action RPG that's developed and published by Nice. Mikhail, have you played Kladden? I haven't.
I'm familiar with the IP because I remember buying the older titles which NIS America released on Steam, and they... You remember when they just started releasing stuff on Steam and they dumped a lot of older games on there?
Yeah.
Picked up whatever. I picked up the stuff. I haven't actually played it. It looked interesting because here's where I am with NIS Japan stuff. I'm always up for trying it regardless of how the reception is in Japan, because I always, like, I'd say one out of three times I find something I really enjoy from NIS in Japan. Like, I really love the Void Terrarium games they do, even though they are flawed quite a bit, but I enjoy the vibe and I enjoy playing them. With Kladden, when I saw Kladden X3 get announced, and Kite used to post about the Japanese release quite a bit, so it looked interesting, and it felt like one of those games which NIS America just passed on, because there's something which a lot of people have noticed, that they haven't been porting a lot of NIS Japan titles to PC. When they do bring stuff to PC, it's usually Falcom or it's the other licensed stuff they do. So I thought maybe they're just investing less resources in these titles, but this one is now coming to everything, like NIS's usual slate of everything. So I'm definitely going to try it. I believe there's a demo for the Japanese release. I probably will give that a go, because it looks like an interesting action RPG. Pretty basic in some ways, but I'm going to try it out. In fact, I might download it after this podcast, the Japanese demo, to see it. I'm just not confident in how NIS America is going to handle the release in the West, marketing-wise, but that's their problem, I guess.
This is one of those things where I didn't realize it had been so long since the previous entry. So Kladden, I think it just means like classic dungeon. I knew the original games were like PSP games back in the 2010s and 2011s. I'm like, I know there was a spinoff recently, right? And like, yeah, there was a spinoff. Kladden Returns, this is Sengoku, recently being 2016, so almost a decade ago. Like, oh, not as recent as I thought. So this is like X3. It's like the fourth game in the series, I guess, because of that one spinoff. Kladden X2 came out in 2011. So it's been a long time since the last like numbered entry, if you will. And like Mikhail, I'm not directly familiar with these games. I'm like aware of them. I think it is cool that NAS America is, you know, how much of this is just, you know, a mandate from their parent company, but I think it's cool that they're at least giving it a full release on as many platforms as they can. So, or at least their normal platforms. So.
Mm-hmm. Next one kind of came out of nowhere for me. We have a new entry in the Princess Maker series, the Princess Maker Children of Revelation, that launched just recently on PC via Steam Early Access. This is developed by D-Zard, all in caps. South Korean studio. I believe this is going to be the first Korean developed Princess Maker, if I recall. This kind of snuck up out of nowhere for me, but that's...
Yeah, I'm aware of the Princess Maker series, but I have no idea like who's the original developer, who owns the IP, who licensed it, and yeah, I'm not aware of like how this new one fits in.
According to Kite's write-up of it, this kind of came about when the developer Desard showcased Children of Revolution at TGS 2024, and the CEO Dong Hyun Kim revealed to the news outlet 4Gamer how the series creator, Princess Maker series creator, Takami Akai, was so impressed by their fan art, even suggested to make them a new game. So they kind of were able to find a great middle ground just by establishing, you know, a connection with the Princess Maker series creator, and not to the point that they were developer Desard was able to obtain the license from Akai's company, Yonago Gainax, to formally produce Children of Evolution as a new Princess Maker altogether. So, and this is going to be the full release of this being planned for Nintendo Switch as well. So both PC and Switch will get the full game when this is finally done. They confirmed in the 4Gamer interview that the default protagonist girl in Children of Evolution is Karen Daidoji, who previously appeared as the protagonist of Princess Maker Cube back in 2001. So thank you to Kite for like the thorough write up about the all the background history of this new entry in the Princess Maker game series. That's cool, you know. I really want to see what the reception is to it, and maybe when it fully comes out, maybe I'll go check it out. The Princess Maker games are like pretty interesting in the way that like they have all these different sorts of endings and the way that you raise your daughter throughout them. Like, there's definitely some entries where like you can basically raise her to the point that where she can kill God. These games can get pretty wild in that regard with so many different endings.
I'm just on the Steam page here. I'm not very familiar with these games, but like there's this little GIF that shows the princess on a barn trying to feed a carrot to a little like pink sheep thing. Being very successful. I don't know. It's cute. So
yeah. The raising genre. You know, not a lot of like significant entries these days, but definitely Princess Maker has earned that legacy just like of like continued excellence throughout it, kind of providing an experience in a way that no other series has been able to really encapsulate. So good on them, you know. That's really interesting that they let a South Korean studio take their shot at it, and hopefully that you know, throughout early access they continue to build upon it and listen to player feedback where need be. But that's cool. We got a new update, I believe, as of Anime Expo as well. Out of Anime Expo, Novect, who were the developers on The House in Fata Morgana, they were on the Axis Games Anime Expo panel because Axis Games, AKCSYS, not Arxis, Axis, announced that they will be publishing Novect's new game, Project Code M, for PS5 and Switch. So they don't have a formal name for it yet. It's still under a Project Code name, but Project Code M. And, you know, a lot of people are keeping their eye on this because a lot of people love The House in Fata Morgana. Very impressive visual novel. Very like that gothic art style and deals with some heavy topics in it. This one seems to be like a murder mystery adventure type game. Mikhail, what do you want to say?
Yeah, so when they announced this, it was in development. It was just confirmed for like PlayStation 4, Switch, and Steam, and they had no publisher, they had no partner for localization or anything. This was announced a few years ago, I believe in 2022, if I'm not mistaken. And I just assumed it would be limited run games again because they were so successful with that Fata Morgana physical, which they did for Vita, PS4, and Switch, to the point where I just thought, like, you know, they just go with them. And I was dreading that because I stopped buying from limited run games. So them partnering with Axis for the console version and also doing a PS5 version instead of PS4 is like perfect, because Axis means you have great distribution for physical. You have much better promotion compared to limited run games for the digital release. And so far, I've not been disappointed with Axis' localization. So I think it's like a win-win for everyone involved, especially the fans, because they won't need to like get into that FOMO bullshit for getting a physical copy for this game whenever it does come out. Right. Although I do think they might need to move it to Switch too, depending on how long it takes, because they don't have a year for it either. It's literally just in development, and they've like the Novect account on Blue Sky, they just posted like a short FAQ which says, when's the release date? Still in development, please hang in there. And then, oh yeah, literally even, I just missed this. They said, what consoles will it be on? And they said, depending on the situation, at release, likely PS5 and Switch 2, but wait for any official announcements. So that's something I missed. And they posted this on Blue Sky later on. So I'm very excited for this because Fata Morgana is in like my top 5 games of all time. I own that and I've played that everywhere. In fact, the last time I interviewed Hanada Keika from Novact, he actually sent me a signed copy of the game on Switch. Like,
oh, that's cool.
One of the best presents I've ever gotten. So yeah, I'm super excited for this one.
Yeah. So and they clarified also that Access is only handling the console versions of the English speaking consoles, or the handling the console versions of the English release in that regard. So the Steam release, it seems like Novect is handling the Steam release correctly. I'm not sure 100%.
It definitely seems like it is, because the way they phrase the posts on social is Access is just handling the console version in English speaking regions, and they are still working on they haven't announced the partners for, I think they said Japan and China, or they just said English speaking regions is Access. They haven't announced the console partners for the other regions. Steam is probably going to be self-published because it's easiest to do there, I guess. So they can do that and they handle everything. But hopefully it's a simultaneous launch. Like, I hate those delayed things because it just messes up everything, and like the hype cycle for them, like players have to wait and stuff like that. Just have everything together. So hopefully that's how it is when it finally releases.
All right, on to the next news story. Fantasy Life Online continues to get more updates. They've released version 1.4, which adds new area challenges, materials, fixes some of the blurry visuals that Switch 2 version was suffering, and more. I haven't booted this up in a while. Mikhail, have you been able to check out version 1.4 for Fantasy Life Online?
Yeah, so I mainly have been playing it on Switch 2, and like, this is one of those situations where it's like that Seinfeld gif where George Costanza just says aha and points, because when I mentioned the blurry visuals to friends who played on Switch, they just said, oh, you're just Digital Foundry brained. It looks the same to me. It looks fine to me. And I said, how are you not seeing this? It looks as bad as the Switch 1 version now. And they said, no, you're just imagining it. And I was like, okay, I'm just not going to play it until they fix it. And then the CEO of Level 5 posted on Twitter saying, apologies for this, we're going to fix it due to some bug. The visuals are blurry in some on Switch 2 for some users or something like that. And I was like, I wonder why that's the case. So yeah, I'm very happy that they finally fixed it, because I was not happy with how it looked at all after this. It was unbelievably blurry.
You showed that to your friends, like, see, the CEO sees
literally,
it.
I literally sent that, and I sent the same George Costanza gif, and I was like, here, I wasn't imagining it. So yeah, that, excuse me, besides that, I'm just surprised at how much they're still...
Ping me too.
Like, I'm just surprised at how much they are adding. Okay. I'm just surprised at how much they're still adding before they even do their big free DLC update, which is coming. Like, this... I feel like this game is getting too much support, if that makes sense. Like, it's scary.
Too much support.
Yeah, it's like they're overcompensating for like all the delays, and it's like, yes, Hino, I trust you. I'll give you money for Inazuma 11. Stop it. Like, take a break and go home. Like, we're good with the game now. So yeah, like, it's, they just keep adding more stuff to do. I've not focused on much of the post game now, because I'm at the stage where any of my friends who buy the game, I'm just helping them with multiplayer. Nice. So I haven't done a lot of the farming, because all the people who were focused on farming are now busy in like either Monster Hunter, or they've gone back to Marvel Rivals. That's like my friends who I was playing with. So it's kind of like one of those things where it's like they're just going to come back for, I guess, when there's a bigger update. But the people who are buying a Switch 2 right now and are getting Fantasy Life, they're all just messaging me saying, let's play online, let's play online. So I'm just doing some stuff with them. But I think there was one quality of life thing they changed, which I can't remember right now offhand, but there was something they fixed, which a lot of people were praising in Jaina or Moshe. I'll probably like see if I can mention it next time when I play it more. But seems like everyone's just happy with the update, and I'm happy that they're bringing out the updates now on all platforms together, so there's no drama with, like, you know, features missing and stuff. So hopefully that cadence has arrived, because there's like obviously this might be a pre-release thing and I'm not under embargo for it, but System Shock 2 25th anniversary remaster, I've gotten the Switch version to cover. And I can't play online with the PC version because there's a version mismatch, but like this might be a pre-release thing, but I'll find out in a few days when it goes live. But we've had a lot of these issues with other games like No Man's Sky, where cross-save does not work on Switch and Switch 2 because Nintendo takes longer to approve the patches or whatever. So I hope Level 5 at least has sorted that out, because there are loads of people on my list just playing this on Switch 2 right now. So yeah.
Moving on, there's been more characters revealed for Atelier Resliriana. I cannot say that name. The Red Alchemist and the White Guardian. They showed off some of the characters that will be appearing in the game that Kite has put up in this news write-up for it. Also noteworthy that pretty much the main cast from the Atelier Resliriana mobile game will be showing up. Like with Resna and Valeria or Valerie, those are their names. Valeria, those are the two main characters of that mobile game, along with some of the party members that they had there will show up, and some of the villains that showed up in the mobile game. As to what extent, I can't imagine that you need to know much about them, if at all. I assume that the game will introduce you to them for people who didn't play the mobile game, but it is just funny that they show up. I don't know to what extent. But it's cool that they have high-res models for, like, a game that was built up for consoles instead of mobile. So that's cool. I think I'm going to get this game.
Well, as long as they don't have gacha mechanics, I'll definitely give it a try.
I don't usually get Atelier games. That's the thing. But, like, I like what I see. But, you know, that's coming out still late September. So still kind of a ways off. There was a Bandai Namco showcase earlier this week that it seems like people weren't really, they weren't really satisfied with, but they did have some bits of information that they showed off. They released the first Guardian trailer for Towa and the Guardians of the Sacred Tree, the new roguelike that they revealed at SGF. They released a trailer for Rekka and Nishiki. One of them is the big fish man that you see in the trailers. They also mentioned that even in development, the developers themselves like the fish man, one of their favorites. So it's kind of a nice unified front where both the people and both the developers and the people have strong feelings towards the fish man. And you know what? We're all so right for it. You know, we wish the best for the Fishman. I think when I pick this up, I'll probably play the Fishman first. They seem cool.
You kind of have to pick two characters when you play the game.
Right.
So you pick like a sword wielder and a staff wielder.
I don't know who's going to be my second character then. I know one of them will be Fishman. That's it. That's how far I thought through this. Was the Fishman playable in the demo, SGF demo
build? I don't remember if they were playable. I know that I did not play as them.
Okay. Let's see. They also had a gameplay intro trailer for Dragon Ball Z Kakarot Daima Part 1. So this is part of the new expansion content with the Daima storyline and characters for DBZ Kakarot. They also... mentioned it's not a news article, but they're finally bringing over the PS5 Xbox Series graphical enhancements from DBZ Kakarot into the Steam version soon. People have been kind of awaiting that for a while, for people who are still playing that game. Like, there's like, they added a lot more like vibrance to the foliage, had better water reflections for the PS5 Xbox Series versions that just didn't get ported over to Steam until now. So and that'll be through a free update. So they introduced, you know, the gameplay intro for the Daima content, and also bringing over those graphical enhancements for free at some point in the near future. The DBZ Daima content is paid, though. Only the graphical update. Let's see here. They also had a new deep dive for Digimon Story Time Stranger. They didn't really showcase anything too new for this from what I skimmed, but it's just producer Hara getting up and showing Digimon Story Time Stranger to more people who may have not been following this game. It's an ideal place to showcase it for people who wanted, you know, to see all the Bandai Namco stuff, but they weren't, like, you know, didn't see Time Stranger yet. This was like a deep dive, kind of introducing the basics of the game and all the RPG systems that Time Stranger has. So just good to see that Bandai Namco, you know, recognizes, hey, we really want to push the marketing on Time Stranger because we think we have something cool in our hands. And you know what? They're right for it.
But yeah, this summer showcase in general was basically just like, I think the only new announcement was a My Hero Academia game, another arena fighter. But otherwise, it was mostly just like a quick look, maybe sometimes a not so quick look, at basically every single game that they have coming out soon, which is quite a lot. So it was not much in terms of like new announcements, more just kind of like, here's some gameplay, here's a quick, you know, chat with the developer or like a message from the producer or whatever. So yeah, just a bunch of little updates like that for, you know, all these games, including like there's a little bit from that Blood of Dawnwalker game, Patapon. There's a little bit on Super Robot Wars, and basically everything. Little Nightmares, everything that Bandai Namco is doing. So
even stuff like Code Vein 2, which isn't out till like next year, just like, hey, this exists. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, they're very, very busy on that front, and they kind of teed us up too. Even though people, like a lot of people, had like bigger expectations, they already said, hey, we're announcing a new My Hero Academia game. And they didn't mention anything else beyond that in terms of, like, any promises. Like, they already kind of tried to set people's expectations, but, you know, people always want the world with showcases.
I know a lot of people were hoping for that Tails remaster to show up, which I don't blame them when they literally said, the next Tails remaster will be announced this summer, and then here is our summer showcase, and it's not there. Like, okay, yeah, I get it.
Yeah, that's fair. I agree. Yeah. I would have thought this would have been the place. Like you mentioned earlier, Neverwinter Nights 2 Enhanced Edition, you know, got recently announced. They showcased a gameplay trailer that goes over the expansions that'll be included with that Neverwinter Nights 2 Enhanced Edition release. That's like, what, 3 expansions? It's like Mask of the Betrayer, Storm of Zaheer, and Mysteries of Westgate.
So yeah,
that's a lot of game. Like, you will not be starving for content if you pick this up. You pick this up and you're guaranteed like 150 hours probably.
Like I said earlier, I've never played Neverwinter Nights 2. I'm really curious about it, but I know, like, especially with all the expansion content, and that's not even including all of like the player generated content,
right?
Over the years, it's just there's a lot there. Mask of the Betrayer, especially, I've heard a lot about this over the years. So as a good expansion.
Oh, that's cool. We also got a new trailer for the upcoming Trails in the Sky First Chapter remake. This time, for the regional city of Rouen. Just showing off more gameplay footage on what Rouen looks like in this remake. You know, good on them for continuing to just show off more to this game and what it looks like. Rouen looks great. They showed off the next batch of characters in this with Julia, Gilbert, Dean Collins, Jill, Hans, etc. Both the English, Japanese, and the traditional and simplified Chinese trailers as well, and their voice casts with them. So, well, also a September release as well. So, we're getting there. We're getting there. Just a couple of months away. That'll be fun. We have a sales update this week. Cygames has announced that Granblue Fantasy Relink has sold over 2 million copies worldwide. That released last February, February 2024. That was pretty hot for several months. And then obviously, you know, people got to see most of like what that game had to offer, had a lot of fun with it. That was very popular here with us as well.
I'm kind of surprised they stopped updating it so suddenly. Because it seemed like after launch, they had a pretty regular cadence of updates for like a few new characters, a couple new bosses or whatever. Like it released in February, and I think it like was updated until like June that year. And then they just kind of like just cut it. There's like no more updates. That's it. Like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I think they wanted to keep their expectations in check because they didn't know exactly how well this would do. And I don't blame them because this game had such a troubled extended development.
They just wanted to get it done and put a bow on it.
Yeah. Yeah, so I imagine now if they were to revisit Relink and make another, like, a Relink 2, I think it would have, like, bigger, grander ambitions, probably have a more extended, like, roadmap for it if they were to, like, embark on such a project again. So I don't blame them for finishing that roadmap and then kind of, you know, being done with it. I'm okay with letting games end on that end. I imagine if they do another project, it'll have bigger ambitions next time around.
Do we have any? Do we know what like Cygames Osaka is doing now?
They are currently supporting Uma Musume Pretty Derby.
I see horse girls everywhere on my social feed.
Yes, so
horse girls and Subway Slammers.
I was gonna say I find the lore about some of the horse girls is more interesting than watching the game itself.
It's pretty interesting to see like how well they kind of stay true to the real life horses of what the anime girls are representing. Like I believe like there's like this horse named Haru Urahara or Uraha or something who is famous because that horse has never won a race. So the anime girl version of that horse is like kind of a failure, like has really really bad stats and. But people are trying to do their damn best to like win with her because they're like cheering for the underdog. That's one of the many stories I hear from people playing that game. And it's cool to see that, you know, this game has been going on in Japan for like 4 to 5 years now. And all like the veterans in Japan are like extending like, you know, their love of the game to like the overseas players. Saying, hey, like, thanks for checking this game out. This is my favorite horse girl. You know, I love them to death. Here are all the drawings I've made of them. Like, thanks for checking this game out. And like, I think that's like such a very, like, heartwarming trying to communicate with each other across overseas about like your love for the game and not love for horses and or horse girls. So you know, and on our Discord, I guess also on our Discord mobile game channel, like it's just been a gigantic tidal wave of Uma Musume talk and conversation over the past few days. Just a lot of our community is checking that game out and just falling in love with it, and that's cool to see, you know. So that's been all over my socials and all over our community for that game. People are going wild over it. That's fun. So I have to imagine they have other projects that they're working on that there's just like they're way too early to comment on what they're doing right now. I imagine they're doing something. They have other projects in development.
Do you remember that one game that Cygames showed? It was like Project Awakening or something.
Awakening, I have no idea. But like they've been radio silent on that game. That for people who don't remember, this is like their medieval fantasy Western inspired game that they've showed off for like a couple years. Like, but it was like many years ago since our last update on it. I have no idea what's going on with that game whatsoever. They've been radio silent on that game for since like I want to say 2020 or 2019. Was like the last time you ever heard of that game. So I don't know.
Maybe that's their next big thing. I don't know. But we haven't heard anything for like, I don't know, 3 years now. So I don't know.
They also have that like that competitive game that was they recently hired like the Kenichiro Takaki who got their claim to fame through the Senran Kagura series. But then dipped out of that, and then they were hired by Cygames, and then now they were working on some competitive thing for Cygames. I forgot exactly what it was called, but that project has been under wraps as well. I don't know. Cygames has like a lot of like projects that we just haven't heard of for a very long time. Adam, you pulled up our page for Project Awakening. When was the last time you heard about this game?
So this game was I don't know if this was when it was first announced, but like they revealed it for PlayStation 4 in 2018, Project Awakening, and then it went dormant for 3 years, and then it showed up again in 2021 at like a tech conference, and as far as I know, hasn't shown up again since. So
yeah,
So 4 years ago.
What a mysterious project. I would hope to, like, I hope that project is still in development, because I do want to see what a Cygames Western medieval fantasy game looks like. But who knows? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that Cygames has a... I remember this one. Here, let me share a screenshot in our chat here. They have like a Metal Max game that they're working on.
A Metal Max game?
Yeah, they somehow got the license to that. I remember seeing this. I don't remember how long ago we saw that. But yeah, they have a Metal Max game. They have this mage game called
Gom. Oh yeah, that's not what I was thinking of. Gom, the Garden Arena Magic Mages of Magickery. Yeah, I remember that one.
And Project Awakening is on their website, so it's right there.
Yeah, I totally forgot. Lost Order was the game that they were producing with... I forgot what this was with. I think this was Platinum Games, and I think they canceled it, last I heard.
If you go to their website, the last update is on 2017, so even older than... But it's on their... Yeah. It's listed on their in-development section of their website.
They just never updated it. I don't know. That's weird. Project Gam, Mikhail is the Takaki one. Yes, correct. And then Lost Order was the mobile game that they were developing with Platinum Games. I played like a beta version of that, and I was like, oh, okay, this is kind of interesting. But that just, I feel like this is totally canceled for that. Okay, we only have a few more left here. We have a demo for Front Mission 3 Remake that's now available on Switch. So if you're curious to see that, you can go check it out for free. You have a playable tutorial, like a Choi Kusin combat system, and you get a few pages from the in-game network that we spoke about that was filled with what is allegedly a lot of generative AI images on that end. So if you're a see it to believe it kind of person, you can check this out for free and see if it's up your alley, or just want to see what they've done with this game compared to the original. Cannot say I recommend it based on our discussions with Cullen last week, but you know, do what you do. We also have a release date for System Shock 2 25th Anniversary Remaster for consoles. It's launching on July 10th for PS5, PS4, Xbox, and Switch. They had to delay this and do a stagger release. Like the one on Steam is now currently out, but they had to delay the console versions, and now we got a date for them on July 10th.
It was supposed to be just a single release for all the platforms, but then they had to, it was like a last minute console delay. So it's like a few week delay for that.
Probably some certification sort of thing that probably took longer than they expected. So yeah. And if you want to know more, Adam, you spoke about it last week, I believe, on your thoughts of the game. All that stuff seems to be a damn solid work on re-updating this game and remastering it. And yeah, that's all the news that we have for this week. Thank you for following us, and thank you for listening to the entirety of this podcast episode if you made it up to this point. We'll be back next week, but I have no clue what we'll have, but we will have something. We also have some Anime Expo announcements that, you know, that might be relevant to us. The Anime Expo is still ongoing, so we might have something pop up. And then we'll report back on that if it does. You can follow us on our main site, rpgsite.net. You can follow us on socials, whether through Blue Sky or X/Twitter, through @rpgsite. Facebook.com/rpgsitenet. You can check out all our podcast episodes over at YouTube via youtube.com/rpgsitenet. You can listen to this episode on your favorite podcast app. We'll be there. Until then, I don't know what we'll have next week, but we will have something, and Brian and James will be back, so they'll be back and discussing their trips to both Fan Expo and Anime Expo as well. So, once again, thank you joining me, Adam and Mikhail, and Chao had to step out earlier for this podcast episode, and until next week.